Hello and welcome to the Silmarillion Seminar. This is the beginning of a new feature on the Tolkien Professor podcast, and I'm very excited about it. I know that many people have a hard time with the Silmarillion, and I've been wanting for a long time to do a detailed discussion of it. This seminar is going to be a weekly discussion in which we work through the Silmarillion a chapter at a time between now and probably the beginning of summer 2011. I hope you all enjoy listening along. Let me explain a few technical matters before I get to the recording. The seminar has about 15 to 20 members, so I wanted to use a software that would allow us all to interact in real time as non-chaotically as possible. I'm using the Adobe Connect software, which allows me to call on individuals and activate their microphones when they want to ask a question or make a comment, and that's been working out reasonably well. During a session, there's also a live text chat going on, and you will hear that I occasionally make reference to something that one of the participants has typed in the chat box. The audio quality is okay, with two significant exceptions. When this first session was recorded on December 8th, I had a really bad head cold. In fact, I thought all day I was going to lose my voice entirely. I didn't quite, but I sound pretty ugly, and I apologize for that. The other issue is a strange thing that Adobe Connect does in a few places to the sound quality of the recording. There are about a half dozen moments when the sound distorts strangely, making my voice sound like the voice of a Star Wars droid. Actually, I think it's kind of a cool effect, but I do wish I could make it happen on cue instead of randomly. In any case, I hope that you'll be able to bear with these little quirks and enjoy the discussion despite them. Does anybody have anything that you would like to start with? Let's see, here, Jeremy, go ahead.
Yes, but before I started reading the Silmarillion, I found that reading Tolkien's letter to Milton Waldman was incredibly useful, just as kind of an outline of what's going on. And it does give some specific details, but I think it's just incredibly useful to read before actually getting into the Silmarillion itself.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's like the short version of the whole thing, which is extremely useful. It's good to have a good general outline of the story in your mind. Again, the problem that I've said this before, one of the big problems that people tend to have with the Silmarillion is that it's people get bogged down in the details. People get bogged down in all the names and all the stuff. And the letter to Milton Waldman really does give you a good general introduction. It is the you can find the letter if you have the second edition of the Silmarillion, the one that I have linked to on my website in my bookstore. It contains at least a big selection from this letter. It's a 1951 letter. I actually don't have my copy of the letters on me. If any of you actually happen to have a copy of the selected letters with you, and you could note the number of that letter in that edition, that'd be really cool. But I don't happen to have mine with me, so I don't know it. But yeah, Jeremy, that's a great piece of advice for people to kind of start off with an overview. Let's see, which audiobook has the best pronunciation? Well, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of selection as far as unabridged audio is concerned. There's really just one edition of each one. Robert Inglis's pronunciation is generally better than Martin Shaw's, the guy who does the Silmarillion recording. He makes some mistakes, many more mistakes in pronunciation than Robert Inglis does. But though actually, of course, by far the best pronunciation that you'll get is in the recording of Tolkien reading it in the Tolkien audio collection, which has all of the recordings of Tolkien himself reading his poems and things. You can hear a lot of his pronunciation, certainly of the Elvish. And at the end of that recording, the sort of the last parts of it, is Christopher reading from the Silmarillion. And it's interesting to hear him pronounce things. There were some things that I found I was pronouncing wrong when I listened to that for the first time. As for instance, the mountain upon which Manwë and Varda live is apparently, Christopher pronounces it Tenequitil, and I did not have the stress on that syllable. Let's see, you can buy the Tolkien audio, and there is shamefully not a link for it on my webpage, which I am hoping to, just a complete horrifying oversight on my part, but I will be rectifying that soon, I hope. And Laura has found the letter. Letter 131 is the letter that we're referring to. And it is the letter that he wrote. Basically, this was his pitch to try to get the Silmarillion published during his lifetime, which didn't work. But anyway, so that's it's a really valuable resource. Yeah, page 143, as Nick says. Excellent. Fantastic. Let's start with some pronunciations. Can just people just sort of list out names that you would like to hear from? Okay, let's see. Justin asks, since the accent is primarily on the second syllable, why put it on the third for the Ainu Lindele? Well, the best answer there is you think of what Ainu Lindele means. It breaks. It's the song or the music of the Ainu or Ainu, and Lindale, which means the song or music. Often in Elvish words, you put the stress on the second to last syllable, but there it doesn't work with the whole thing. Ainu Lindale doesn't really work. The whole thing's a compound word. You tend to put the stress on the first and the third syllable there because that's where they would fall naturally on those words independently. Other pronunciation questions, words, names that you would like pronounced? No, anyone? One question that people will sometimes have is where does the stress fall in Iluvatar? And it tends to be the second syllable there, Iluvatar. You'll notice in most editions of the Silmarillion, you get the accent marks over names, and the accent marks are primarily designed to assist in pronunciation, actually. So you can see that the accent mark has been put over Iluvatar, over the U. So that's how you know you're supposed to put the stress there. Yeah, Mike asks, is Iluvatar meant to echo in some way, illuminate, like it seems to refer to light? It does sound like it's hard to resist that connection, but I have to say, I think it's a coincidence. Basically because the word doesn't mean that in Elvish. He's building these words out of these languages that he himself is designing, and so you have to really consult the Elvish etymologies to really see what the connections of the words are. They often they will sometimes make puns in English, or they'll sometimes sound like or look like English words. Often that's really just a coincidence. And I think this is that. I think that's a coincidence too. But I don't know. Let's see, a few other pronunciation questions. El Dalie, stress on the second syllable there. And then Ea, E-A, it's two syllables. And again, if you look at how it's printed in almost all the editions, if you look at how it's printed, you have the two dots, the little umlaut above the A, and that's those are to indicate that this vowel, those are put over a vowel in order to make sure that it gets pronounced. And when you have a double vowel, that it just like two vowels side by side, as in Ea, he puts it over there to make sure that you know this is supposed to be two syllables. It's not supposed to be just one syllable. So Ea and Aule would be both of those two syllable words. Aule, the AU sound, sounds like ow. So Aule. Okay. Other issues. I guess we could sort of move on to some kind of bigger questions. There's so much to talk about in the Ainu Lindele. And it's sort of hard even to know where to start. Laura has a question. Let me call on you here, Laura.
Yeah. I'd like to ask, about the difference between the name Eru and the name Iluvatar. Do they mean the same thing, or are they two different meanings there?
They're in two different names, or rather, they're in two different languages. It's interesting the way that he points it out. That is, he doesn't just say there is, Eru, who is also sometimes called Iluvatar in a different language. The way that he says it is there was Eru, the one, who in Arda is called Iluvatar. So he doesn't just say like among some people in Arda he is called Iluvatar, and among others he is called Eru. The way that he makes it sound is that Eru is his real name, and Iluvatar is just what he's called, by the elves. I can't remember offhand the etymologies of Iluvatar, but he, in the original drafts, I was just rereading from the Book of Oz Tales, the first draft of the Music of the Ainur earlier today, and in the Music of the Ainur, he talks about the language of the gods, you know, that the Valar themselves had a language, which is different from any of the languages that the Eldar speak, and that eventually the Eldar don't really speak in it, and the Valar speak in the Eldar's language to talk with them, and then they don't talk in their own language among the elves that much. So I'm sort of wondering if that's kind of a relic from that. Let's see, Joe?
Yeah, I was just wondering, it says when Melkor first started his own theme that there were some that attuned their music to his. I was wondering if that would be Maiar, possibly, and then also about the three different themes that happen. I was also, if those themes are related to the other stories later on in the Silmarillion.
Yes, that is a sort of a qualified yes I would give to that. First off, I would say, let me approach them first. The others who attune their music to him, yes, those would be Maiar. I mean, all of the people that we see, his servants following him, would be those who came along with him. And basically this is sort of following the same trend in the story as in the traditional Christian story of the fall of Lucifer and the many angels who maintained allegiance to him and fell with him. As you know, of course, you know, the Balrogs are even referred to as demons at various times. So they do operate like that. The question, I was actually just addressing this on my Facebook page the other day. The distinction between Valar and Maiar is something that can easily be overstated, I think. It's sometimes tempting. Sometimes people will speak of the Valar and the Maiar as if they're like two different species. They're just like two totally different things. They're not. They're all Ainur. The Ainur, the music of the Ainur, this group of people, you know, this choir of creatures who are singing at the beginning are all of them put together. There's the Valar and the Maiar, or those who will become the Valar and those who will be called the Maiar. They're all Ainur. Ainur is the general classification of them. And among the Ainur, some of them are greater and some of them are lesser, and some of them have a broader understanding, sort of know more of the mind of Iluvatar, and some of them know less or sort of have a more specialized understanding of it. And so when many of these spirits, though not all of them, come down into Arda, we see that some of them are much more powerful and some of them less, some of them very focused, some of them some of them have, you know, again, are sort of have a broader authority and a broader power. And in Tolkien's own mind, I mean, as these stories were developing from his first drafts back in the late teens and early 20s, all the way through his death, and he was revising these stories for 50 years, and he definitely... things kind of shifted around. I mean, who gets ranked among the great of the Valar and who are sort of comparatively minor changes from draft to draft. So, I mean, it was clearly a sort of a fluid situation in his head. And I think that it's important for us to keep that in mind, you know, that you don't just think about this really solid line between the Valar and the Maiar, because there are many occasions on which we see, you know, that line really being blurred. Many of the stories later on that we're going to get are going to involve that. I mean, certainly when we get to the character of Ungoliant, for instance, she is a massively powerful creature, but you know, technically she's a Maiar. So, and you know, Sauron too. There's not all that much between Sauron and some of the Valar as well. So, you know, it's tricky. I think we need to remember that they were all involved in the song, and they are all important, and they're all part of the same group there. Okay, let's see. John, you have been patient.
One question that was on my mind was, for example, the short term for Ainur, the singular term, is Ainu, and has a very similar sound to Eru in some ways. I didn't know if that was just coincidence, or a term like Elu Thingol. So with these terms, therefore, are they somehow related in the sense that they're all from like the same linguistic root in Quenyan or something, or are we talking just like a coincidence being repeated?
Well, that's a good question. I think my suspicion there actually would be neither. That is neither a coincidence nor an actual derivation between the two, primarily because the similarity in the three of them is the ending. And the ending would be less likely actually to have to do with the etymology and more to do with the morphology of the language. And also, Eluthingol, I think, to be in a different language. But here, when I'm speaking of the languages, I'm speaking on my I'm standing on my weakest ground. I know much less about the languages than I should. I am a very paltry linguist, which is a deep item of shame for a Tolkien scholar, I have to admit, since Tolkien himself was so dedicated to the languages. But sadly, it is true. It is one of the things that I am that I'm really looking forward to changing at some point. Elizabeth, you had a question about the themes, which is good because that was brought up and then we kind of dropped it. So let's get back to that.
Yes. I've always wondered, are the first two themes, were they like rough drafts and the third theme was the one that was used to make the world, or were all three themes involved in the making of the world? I've just always been confused about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think they're not rough drafts in the sense of they are, you know, not not actually sort of a final, like they get scrapped afterwards or something like that. That they're not only the warm-up acts for the third theme. In fact, we learn later in the Einherjarl that Manwë was the chief instrument of the second theme. So we know that there's some significance there. I mean, Manwë is really as the chief instrument of that theme, and we see how significant he is and how important he is. And so therefore he's not just like the warm-up act, obviously, and has a huge role to play in the playing out of the third theme. And the central point of the third theme, that there are two things that we learn about the third theme, of course, the third theme is so heavily emphasized there. One, of course, is its beauty and its sorrow. And of course, it's the sorrow from which its beauty chiefly came. And also the fact that the children of Ilúvatar come in the third theme. So the third theme is really important, but it's not the whole thing. And I think one thing that's difficult to, that's hard to keep in mind, it can be really confusing about the themes, is I think that we need to resist thinking too mechanically and too rigidly chronologically about the themes. And here's what I mean by that. And this actually gets back to a question, Joe, I think you asked before, which I kind of skipped over in answering other things. And that is, can we see in the themes anticipations of stuff that happens later in the Silmarillion? And the answer to that, I think, is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that we can see foreshadowed many of the kinds of struggles and difficulties. The war, and not only the fact of the conflict between Melkor and the other Ainur, but also the nature of that conflict as it's described, and the way, especially, that the third theme overcomes it, and the final sort of image of contrast that we're given between the third theme and the discord of Melkor. Those are all things that I think do provide us with cues, and that we can see those cues being taken up later on in the Silmarillion. But I don't think if we try to do it, as I said, sort of rigidly or mechanically, and look at it chronologically and say, okay, like, where's the Battle of Sudden Flame? You know, where's the Battle of where's the Nir Naith or Noidiad? And can we see Turimbar specifically? And no, I don't think so, because I don't think that it's necessarily chronological in that rigorous way. The vision that they can remember, there are three, not only are there three themes, there are sort of three movements that we get in the whole kind of creation process. The first step is the music. The entirety of the music and the whole music is played, and the music of the Ainur contains this, the narrative of all creation, but it also contains again, not just the story, but like the whole theme and idea of creation. Then you get the vision, in which they see the story, and there the vision is chronological, and it cuts off at some point. They don't see it all the way through to the end, and then we actually start up time for real after Eru says Ea, be, and everything actually comes to exist. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that the music, it's not just like, okay, you know, like this measure of the music would correspond to this particular year. I don't think that that's exactly how the music works. So again, I think that we need to be careful. And that's why, therefore, also the nature of the thing, I think that the important thing to look at in the themes is we get this clear correlation with Ilúvatar's own attitude. Right. That is, Melkor's discord begins. This is on page 16 of the edition on the website. And Eru lifts up his left hand. He's smiling and he lifts up his left hand and a new theme begins. And it has a new beauty. And then he rises and his countenance is stern. And then the third theme begins. So the first theme is the first one that they're singing. The second theme, he's smiling and he lifts his left hand. The third one is his countenance is stern and he lifts his right hand. And then in the end, he rises a third time and his face is terrible to behold. And he raised up both of his hands and in one chord, deeper than the abyss, higher than the firmament, piercing as the light of the eye of Ilúvatar, the music ceased. So I think that we can see... looking at sort of the attitude and the response of Ilúvatar is, I think, really important there, rather than thinking about it as a kind of a sequential narrative. Okay. Let me see to that in a second. Yeah, okay, Chris wants to talk about the themes.
Okay, I guess when I was thinking about the themes, and this something that I think the Dalla Quinta ends on, as far as the concept of Arda marred versus yes. How Arda was supposed to be sung, and that the music at the end of time would be sung as it was intended. And I guess I'd always kind of envisioned maybe the first theme really countenance to what Arda was supposed to have been before Melkor started down his road. Just a thought I had, just thought I'd throw it out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a really good thought, Chris. We do see Ilúvatar responding to Melkor and to the discord. So I agree. The first one is the one that he gives them in the beginning, and so there is a sense of fall and recovery in the music, and that the music is going to be played aright someday. So I agree with that. There is going to be a kind of a restoration. Now, the third theme, which is, it's the second to last, the last being the final chord, which brings everything to an end. But the third theme is in this sense sort of the most reactive. It's the one that finally is overcoming him, and it's the really sad one. And so we can see sorrow, we can see suffering, and not just suffering. Suffering is intrinsic in the discord already. Melkor has introduced suffering through his act of rebellion. What Ilúvatar has done in the third theme, which is really one of my favorite parts of the whole Aina Wendele, is when you see the effect that it has, in the description of the third theme, the discord is it essayed to drown the other music by the violence of its voice, but it seemed that its most triumphant notes were taken by the other and woven into its own solemn pattern. The suffering, the sorrow that has been introduced to the world through the discord is being taken by Ilúvatar and woven into the music itself. So yes, now the music is different than the original conception, and it has, I agree with Chris, in one sense fallen short, or fallen away from the original original perfection of the initial conception of Iluvatar, but the result is not something that's just second rate. The result is something that is even more beautiful than the original one was. One thing that I would say, I was really struck by this when I was reading this earlier today. I mentioned already that I was sort of rereading the Book of Lost Tales version, which is sort of the first draft of the Music of the Ainur, and I was really struck by a passage there where Tolkien really emphasizes the introduction of suffering by Melkor, and I'll read this passage. It's a little bit long, but I found it really striking. In the Ainur Lindale version, Iluvatar emphasizes, when he's sort of going back over it, he talks about the extreme cold and extreme heat that are now going to happen as a consequence of Melkor's actions. But he's much more blunt back in the Lost Tales version. Iluvatar says, "For lo, through Melko have terror as fire, and sorrow like dark waters, wrath like thunder, and evil as far from my light as the depths of the uttermost of the dark places, come into the design that I laid before you. Through him has pain and misery been made in the clash of overwhelming musics, and with confusion of sound have cruelty and ravening and darkness and loathly mire and all putrescence of thought or thing, foul mists and violent flame, cold without mercy been born, and death without hope. Yet is this through him, and not by him. And he shall see, and ye all likewise, and even shall those beings who must now dwell among his evil, and endure through Melko misery and sorrow, terror and wickedness, they shall declare in the end that it redoundeth only to my great glory, and doth but make the theme more worth the hearing, life more worth the living, and the world so much the more wonderful and marvelous, that of all the deeds of Iluvatar it shall be called his mightiest and his loveliest." And I also love the fact that the next sentence after this quotation is, "Then the Ainur feared and comprehended not all that was said, and Melko was filled with shame and the anger of shame." So, I mean, that's... He's getting at all that still. He's left that concept in the Ainur Lindale version, but he really hammers it. I mean, the putrescence and the cruelty and the torment and the death in despair, all of these things. And that's kind of a good preview of the rest of the Silmarillion too. It's pretty striking. Let's see, Mike, you wanted to talk about the attitude of Iluvatar here.
Yes. I just wanted to ask the question, third full paragraph from the beginning. "Show forth your powers in adorning this theme, comma, each with his own thoughts and devices, comma, if he will." And I'm wondering about that last clause, "if he will," and if that first request of the creator to his creations is, if that first statement to them is a request and not a command. And I find that very interesting if the first statement is indeed a request and not a command, because as a reader of The Lord of the Rings, requesting versus commanding is something that comes up again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think it's a really important thing to remember in the Ainur Lindale and thinking of the music itself especially, that what is happening here is not just Iluvatar issuing orders and things obeying. It's not even just that he's not playing music. He is not even like a conductor. He is not like a musician playing on an instrument. He is not even like a conductor conducting an orchestra. He is the audience. He's sitting back. He has devised the theme. He has conceived the music, and he has delivered it to them and says, "Here is the music I want you to play." But they're not reading sheet music. They're improvising it. They're each one, if they will. And Mike, I think you're really right to emphasize that. He makes it optional for them. If you choose to do this, do it. And of course, they choose. Now, Melkor is choosing too. And I think, see, this is a thing that people often misunderstand about the nature of the rebellion of Melkor. Melkor is not, what he does isn't bad because he adorns it with his own thoughts. That is, it is not true that adherence to Iluvatar means uniformity, and it means submission and sort of extinction of self, and just like, you know, don't do your own thing, you know, do Iluvatar's thing. That's not at all the point. Everyone is doing their own thing. Everyone is bringing forth the music. You know, they're all adorning it. The difference is what Melkor adorns it with, and the direction in which he takes it, and his desire to make it to make his own music more prominent. His problem is not that he's improvising; everybody's improvising. His problem is that he wants to have a solo, and that's what makes it such a big deal. But I agree. I mean, I think, you know, Mike, that one for if you will. You know, or if he will there, you know, in that phrase, you can see, I think, a really crucial point about the entire, theology of the Ainu Lindale. It is remarkable the extent to which the free will of the creatures of Iluvatar is foregrounded throughout this. All of creation itself is conceived in the music of the Ainur as essentially an artistic sub-creation of created beings. They, of course, can't make creation. They can't make the world. They can't make it real, that is. They can conceive it artistically. Only Iluvatar has the power to say, Ea, let it be. But what he does, as he explains, is give life and being to this thing which they have conceived. But again, their wills are involved here from the beginning. Let's see. I'm trying to figure out who to call next here. Jack, let me call on you here.
Yeah, the last paragraph, when we learn that this whole story, the Ainu Lindale, is as told to the elves by the Valar. So I think that opens up a whole can of worms, but a lot of interesting points. Number one is we have these, you know, otherworldly beings who are tasked with explaining this to much lesser beings. Even though they're elves, there's still a huge gap. I mean, the Valar, you know, lived in a timeless place. Just understanding what it's like not to be in a linear universe is hard to understand. So I think that opens up the possibility that the Valar may have used metaphor to describe these events to the elves. For example, the music, it might not be music as we understand it, but that's the best way for them to describe it to the elves who could understand it that way, and so forth. What do you think?
Jack, I think it's a really great way to think about it. I mean, there are some places in which I think it's obvious that metaphor is being used in exactly the way that you describe. I mean, for instance, and then the voices of the Ainur, like unto harps and lutes and pipes and trumpets and viols and organs, and like unto countless choirs singing with words. In other words, it's saying it's like that, you know, trying to give these mortal creatures some conception of what the choir of the Ainur was like. Of course, they're not, I mean, but you actually try to picture that. Okay, so some of their voices sounded like harps, you know, exactly like viol, like stringed instruments. You know, so you can see, like, there it is explicit. I am trying to give you some way to comprehend what was going on here. And so I'm going to compare it to something that you're familiar with. Another moment that I think of in the Ainu Lindale, Jack, that really brings home the point that you were making there, is when Iluvatar takes them and he shows them the vision. We think first on page 17, right after they stop the music, and the last sentence of the second paragraph after the break at the end of the music. But Iluvatar arose in splendor, and he went forth from the fair regions that he had made for the Ainur, and the Ainur followed him. So, okay, so we're told that the Ainur live, it's like there are these regions that he's made for them to live in, and that the regions that they live in are fair, right? They're beautiful. Okay, so they live in this beautiful region. Well, that seems fine, except then that we learn after this that they had never had sight, you know, he gives them sight now, where before was only hearing. You know, so if they didn't have sight before, in what sense were the regions that they lived in fair? Well, it's not to say that they can't be, but they clearly are in a way that we can't relate to directly. You know, what kind of connection, what kind of sensory perception did they have? Well, you know, we're told they didn't have anything which correlated to vision, to eyesight. But clearly they had other things. So I think that's another place, Jack, where we can see the fact that this is a story that's being framed in a way for limited creatures to understand. So there is clearly some metaphor going on here. And I think that that's another reason why we can't be too mechanical in our attempts to understand, you know, like the music, or to try to interpret the music and sort of connect it to events and things, because even the introduction of themes, to thinking of the introduction of the three themes chronologically, like as if they are three ages of the world or something, I don't think we can do that exactly, because it's not this story that we're getting. This story that we're told at the very end of the Ainu Lindoe is the story that the Valar themselves told to the elves. This story is not, like, this isn't the way it really happened. This is the only way that the elves themselves could comprehend it. Yeah, Jack, you can go ahead and follow up this.
Yeah, and I agree with what you're saying. And, like, when I was reading it, even when it says Iluvatar raised his right hand and his left hand, so we start thinking that he has a body.
Right.
But later on, we learn that when the Valar descend into Arda, and they need bodies, they don't look to Iluvatar. They look to their vision of the children of Iluvatar when they need a form. So even that right hand and left hand, that's just a metaphor for, you know, his judgments or his pronouncements.
Yeah, absolutely, Jack. I think that's a great point. You can see also if you look at the wording about his facial expressions, similarly to, you know, as if he has, you know, a face with, like, you know, a nose and a features like ours. But you can notice, then Iluvatar arose and the Ainur perceived that he smiled. And we get it again, you know, then again, Iluvatar arose and the Ainur perceived that his countenance was stern. So yeah, like the sternness of his countenance, the raising of his right hand, clearly those are, I think, demonstrably metaphorical in exactly the way that you said. None of these creatures have physical beings or bodies or anything, but it's being characterized in these terms so that, because this is the only way they know how to convey what the attitude of Iluvatar was in that moment. I think those are really great points, Jack. Let's see, Joe, you've been really patient. Let me call on you here.
The first question I kind of have kind of relates back to the smile. I thought it was very interesting that it expressed his emotion there as smiling, and I was wondering if thought maybe he was smiling because he felt Melkor was trying to subcreate, or was it that he pitied Melkor because he knew what was coming, or was it kind of like, haha, you really can't change anything the way you want to. It's going to work the way I want it to work. I guess that was really the first question I had. And then the other one was more of a yes answer, yes or no. It says the triumphant notes of Melkor's was taken from Iluvatar's theme. I was wondering if that represented basically what Iluvatar said after that. You can't do anything on your own. It all comes from me. I was wondering if that was representative of that.
Yes. I mean, definitely. Though, let's see. Okay. If you look at the relation, especially between the third theme of Iluvatar and Melkor's music, the incorporation, the sort of, well, not stealing exactly, but the incorporation that happens is from Melkor to Iluvatar. That is, we see there Melkor taking the, Iluvatar taking the rebellion of Melkor and using that, incorporating that into his glorious theme. What Melkor is trying to do is to drown out, and it essayed to drown the other music by the violence of its voice. end, but it's most triumphant notes, and that's the real sticker there, right? The most triumphant notes. When Melkor is succeeding best are the times when he, far from coming close to winning, are the times, in fact, when he is actually contributing to the glory and beauty of Iluvatar's music most directly. That's got to sting. But that brings me back to the smile. And I think the smile is really... I don't feel like I have a really good intuitive understanding of the smile, because it doesn't feel right to say that he's smiling in mockery. I mean, it would be easy enough, you know, sort of from a human perspective, to imagine Iluvatar up there being like, oh yeah, come on, bring it, Melkor. You're so cute when you rebel. You know, I mean, it's definitely like, easy enough to imagine that, as I say, from a human perspective, but that just does not at all seem to fit or to resonate with the way that we see Iluvatar acting. I mean, I think that what we see here, you know, I mentioned before Iluvatar responding to what Melkor does, and he clearly does, but I don't think that we need, I think that we have to be careful when we talk about responding, his responding to it. From what we see of Iluvatar, I'm not thinking that he's being taken by surprise here, you know, that this is like mere improv that he's doing, that Iluvatar is doing in response to Melkor. He smiles, I think, because he knows this is the direction it was going to go. And ultimately, he is happy with the sort of the direction that it's going. Yeah, I mean, Joe suggesting in the chat here that it could be pity. I think so, possibly. I'm not sure. But also, again, I think it corresponds not just to Melkor personally, but also to the theme, the second theme that he's initiating. The smiling face and the left hand are associated with the second theme. The stern face and the right hand are associated with the third theme. And so I think that those things tell us perhaps more about the themes themselves, the nature of the themes themselves, than about his attitude towards sort of Melkor personally. Justin has in the text raised the... question, which was inevitable to come up sooner or later, that is the question of predestination and free will in all of this. I'm tempted to try to dodge that, because that's always such an awkward philosophical discussion to have at some points, but I don't think I shall, because this work really confronts it. In fact, I would go further to say that I think that the Einar Lindele is one of the most striking literary treatments of the integration of predestination and free will that I know of. And so I don't think that we should dodge it. But I don't want to just go off and talk about that. What do you guys think? Make a note in the chat if you would like to respond to the predestination and free will issue. Alejandro, go ahead. Oh, that's right, you can't talk. Sorry. I forgot about that. Let's see. Alejandro, actually, if you type something, I could read it. So why don't you go ahead and type? You can type sort of a longer thing, and then I can read it. And then in the meantime, while you're typing, I will call on Justin here. Go ahead and respond, Justin.
All right. Well, it's always fun for me to talk about these, because I love poring over seemingly contradictory topics. But at least in terms of Melkor, it would seem that the improvisation was not the problem, and it seems that his intent was the issue to take at hand. The fact that not only did he seek to be as much as he could be, he sought to do it for his own glory. And that was what really comes out in the text, I think, in that he says, in that he points out that he sought to raise himself above the other Ainur and to bring the glory to himself.
Right. That's clearly where his sin is. That's clearly what he does wrong. Yeah, I mean, the predestination and free will question, what I think is perfectly clear from Tolkien's mind here in this passage is that both are clearly happening. I mean, as it, you know, based on that wonderful passage that Mike pointed out, it is perfectly clear that he is leaving their wills free in a remarkable way. They are free to contribute or not to contribute to the music. They are supposed to adorn the music according to their own thought. They are, you know, he emphasizes the freedom of their will. But at the same time, Iluvatar is in control. You just think about the intimacy with which this works. That is their own self-expression and their response to Iluvatar's will. When Iluvatar raises his hand, or sort of whatever he's doing, which is described as raising his hand, when he raises his hand, this new theme springs up. Remember, they're all improvising. They're not following music or anything. So they're all just responding to him, again, freely responding to his urging, to his, you know, to his introduction, his desire to introduce this new theme. Are they doing it? Yes, they're doing it. Is he doing it? Yes, he's doing it. You know, and there's no, you can't just say that it's one and not the other. So I think that that's kind of crucial to keep in mind. Theologically speaking, philosophically speaking, say this in my classes all the time, by far the best explanation of predestination and free will that I know of from within the Christian framework is Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. That is by the Roman author Boethius, Boethius, and his work is called The Consolation of Philosophy. And the primary point to condense Boethius's excellent argument into like 1 minute, the primary point that Boethius makes is that God is outside of time. God is not restricted to time, and that the majority of the problems that we have with predestination, and the reason that it seems to us that predestination removes free will, is that we imagine God and God's knowledge and God's plan happening within time. So if God has determined something from the beginning, if God knows in advance that this thing is going to happen and he is anticipating it and he's foreseeing it, then it's not really free to happen, then it was already going to happen, and so therefore the choices that people appeared to make in bringing it about were just illusory and free will disappears. Boethius's point is, no, that's not the case. God is not in time. He's not in the past looking into the future and foreseeing what's going to happen and foreknowing and foreplanning. He's just seeing and planning. He has the same relationship with all of time. You know, he's entirely outside of time looking down on the whole thing. So that's, and when you think of it in those terms, Boethius then goes on to make sort of an even clearer argument, basically that the problem between predestination and free will, that this is really our problem. That is, they appear to contradict each other from our perspective, but does God know about things in the same way that we do? And Boethius argues, no, God's knowledge is far more perfect than our knowledge. And not just in the sense of like the difference between somebody who knows very little and somebody who knows very much. He says it is like the difference in knowledge that, you know, a human has compared to a barnacle or something. We just have different ways of knowing than crustaceans have. You know, they have very limited, they can't perceive as much. They can't reason. And that God has capacities that we don't have. To us, these two things look simply contradictory. With God, it is not so. A couple of you have commented, Brandon just pointed out that's the problem of Paine's answer. Yeah, C.S. Lewis is leaning heavily on Boethius. C.S. Lewis was a really big Boethius fan. From reading Tolkien, from reading the Ainulindhwe in particular, I'm pretty confident Tolkien was a pretty big Boethius fan too. But I shouldn't spend my whole time talking about Boethius, though. You get me started on Boethius, I will tend to go off very, very, very quickly. So I should be cautious about overindulging my love for Boethius here. Let's say call on somebody else. Let's see, Dusty, let me move on to you here.
The question I have is primarily on, let me read the passage. And some have said that the vision ceased ere the fulfillment of the dominion of men and the fading of the firstborn. Is that the reason the Valar and the Ainur do less as time goes on throughout the books? And do they have a guideline since they don't have a theme to follow? And how do they know what they're supposed to do from the end of the third theme once Iluvatar has cut all the music off? What is their guidepost on what they're supposed to do next?
That's a great question. Let me say one thing that I would clarify first, just to make sure, because I think it isn't true. It isn't quite true to say that they don't know anything about what's going to happen. That the whole thing is kind of a mystery. So it's easy to sort of read that passage and get a slightly wrong impression. Let's see. I'm looking for the passage here. Let's just do it from memory. The passage says, top of page 20, Dustin, thank you. For the history was incomplete, and the circles of time not full wrought when the vision was taken away. And some have said that the vision ceased ere the fulfillment of the dominion of men and the fading of the firstborn. Wherefore, though the music is over all, and the Valar have not seen as with sight the later ages or the ending of the world. And what I would emphasize there is as with sight. They haven't seen it as with sight. So in that sense, they haven't sort of seen the script. Other parts of the story, they've seen the whole story. They know what's supposed to happen, or at least have glimpses of what's supposed to happen. But you'll notice, although they haven't seen it with sight, though the music is over all, we're told. That is, they know how it goes. But again, this is where I would go back to what I said about not being too rigid in how we think about the music that is sort of in direct translation of music to story or to historical narrative, because how we see the music operating is sometimes sort of as much thematically as it is narratively. To give an example, and this is alluding to an event that's going to happen a little bit later, in the conversation that Yavanna and Aule have when she's talking about the Ents, basically, sort of Manwë consults, and when they're talking, you know, she's like, this idea was in the song. And when she's saying that, she does not seem to be saying, hey, don't you remember the bit in the story where this happened? But rather, this conception that I have, this idea that I have, harmonizes with the music that we sang. This was part of the harmonies that we sang. And I think that that's, I would suggest, I think I have suggested at some other point, that you can even see similar things. I think you can hear an echo of that in some of Elrond's words, especially at the end of the Council of Elrond. You know, when he says to Frodo, if I understand aright all that I have heard, Frodo, this task is appointed for you. And there, I don't think he's saying, having evaluated everybody's proposal, I can see what is definitely the best and most efficient idea. Rather, it's like he's saying, if I'm hearing, you know, the echoes of the music here, if I'm understanding the trend here, the kind of story that's being unfolded, if I'm perceiving the way that this fits into the greater cosmic scheme, I think this is what's supposed to happen. Again, it's very, very much less direct. Of course, Elrond has no direct memory of the music or access to it, but as one of the wise, it's one of the things that it means to be wise, right, is to be sort of more in tune with that. So I think that it's important to remember that the music sort of works in that way. So again, Dusty, going back to your passage there, wherefore, though the music is over all, the Valar have not seen as with sight the later ages or the ending of the world. They don't know what's going to happen. They know how the song goes, but they don't know the narrative of what's going to happen. Now, going back to the first point in your question, does this explain why they kind of disappear? Why we don't see them acting, you know, we don't have Orome riding across Middle-earth like he rides across Beleriand in the First Age. Possibly in some ways. I mean, there certainly seems to be a correlation as we get closer to the dominion of men and as the firstborn are fading more and more. In other words, as we're beginning to approach the time that this passage points to in the limitation of the Ainur, of the Valar's familiarity, that does correlate with their seeming to pull back a little bit more. Yet yet I think we have to be careful about that, because it's not I don't think the comparative inactivity or the apparent inactivity of the Valar in Middle-earth is actually a reflection of them doing less necessarily, or rather that it's, you know, certainly not that it's like them being more and more clueless, right? That like in the first stage, they're really, you know, they act a lot because they're confident, because they're like, hey, I've seen this story, I know what I'm supposed to do, and that we're supposed to imagine them as like the third age is going on, that over in Valinor somewhere, the Valar are kind of fumbling around and being like, I don't know, I'm not sure what's supposed to happen next, I think I'll just do nothing. I mean, that I think is definitely not what the Valar are doing. I think that they do act, and they are acting. There are times even in the first age, and we'll see some of these moments as we go through the Silmarillion, moments when it appears to the people in Middle-earth, even back in the first age, that the Valar aren't doing anything, right? Melkor will taunt people with this, like, hey, the Valar have forgotten you guys. They don't care about Middle-earth. Well, no, they do care about Middle-earth. They've never forgotten, but they're not always acting in ways that are obvious and direct. And I think that that kind of not obvious and not direct action is the kind of thing that happens more and more as the ages go on. So I think we have to be careful. But again, there's no question, Dusty, that there is a correlation between those two things. So I think that that's I think that that's important. John, I see we've got you back here.
I was just wondering about the imperishable flame, or fire of Iluvatar. How that works out, the secret fire?
Yeah.
He puts in the heart of Arda. What's your input on that? I mean, is it a metaphor for life itself, like the Holy Spirit? Or where are we going with it, you know, with it here?
Yeah, great question. The imperishable flame, the flame imperishable, is a really interesting concept there. I think that to go so far as to connect it with the Holy Spirit is, I think, going a little bit too far, only in the sense of that's, I think, a little bit too specific. Perhaps broadly, I mean, if you're sort of understanding this as the principle of life, because that, you know, was another thing that you said, and that does seem to be connected with it. If you look at the way in which the flame imperishable is mentioned, you have the first reference is when Iluvatar is talking to the Ainur, and since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, so the flame imperishable, which is with Iluvatar, kindles the Ainur. So it seems to be sort of at the heart of their own life, of their existence. Similarly, there's the reference, it's not to the flame imperishable, but this is at the very bottom of 15 and top of 16. And it's referring to the music being played aright at the end, after the end of days. Then the themes of Iluvatar shall be played aright and take being in the moment of their utterance. For all shall then understand fully his intent in their part, and each shall know the comprehension of each, and Iluvatar shall give to their thoughts the secret fire, being well pleased. So he kindles them with the imperishable flame, but then there's the secret fire that he doesn't give to their thoughts. And I think that, you know, sort of, if we connect three passages, we can see some interesting things here. First, the first one is the very first one that I read, that he kindles them with the flame imperishable. The second is on the next paragraph there, at the top of 16, Melkor is searching for the imperishable flame. He covets it. He wants it. But he doesn't find it, of course, because it's with Iluvatar. I mean, he's not going to just, like, you know, find it under a doormat somewhere. The imperishable flame is the principle of life with Iluvatar itself. But you notice when he talks about the music being played aright, now it's not just being, creation, life, you know, existence. All of these things are connected with the imperishable flame. And Iluvatar is its source. It is with Iluvatar. He can give it to others, right? He can give being. Remember, he's the only one who can give being. They do the music. He shows them the vision. He's the one who says, Ea. And so he's setting the imperishable flame at the heart of Arda. Shows it is now, right? Now it is that which is. It is now Ea, because he has given to it the imperishable flame. But again, you notice the difference between the music that's going to be played at the after the end of days and the music that's being performed now by the choir of the Ainur. Is that there, see, they've got their music, but look at the separation between their music and the imperishable flame. They do their music, the whole music is over, and he's like, okay, you know, that was great. Now I will give it the imperishable flame. Totally separate process. Right now, AI, it will be. Whereas what he emphasizes is when, after the end of days, the themes of Iluvatar shall be played aright, they will take being in the moment of their utterance. Right? So in singing, as they are uttered by the creatures themselves will be enabled by Iluvatar to bring being and not just conception, not just artistic conception, but being. Being in the moment of their utterance, for all then shall fully understand, then understand fully his intent in their part, and each shall know the comprehension of each, and Iluvatar shall give to their thoughts the secret fire. Not just sort of taking it afterwards and saying, okay, yeah, I'm gonna say Aeon now, but basically it's like he will give them actual, sort of fully delegated authority over the secret fire itself, and that I think is really cool. Laura has reminded us of Gandalf's comment, I am a servant of the secret fire. And this is, I think, pretty clearly what Gandalf was referring to and what we should be remembering when we get to that moment. But here, in order to really bring, you know, sort of finally bring together and make sense of this distinction between subcreation and creation, between the sort of the imperfect knowledge that even the Ainur have at this point compared to the perfect knowledge and comprehension that they will have later on when their art, when their subcreative art shall become creative art, shall be perfected and fulfilled. I think you have to, it's really New Testament language that you have to go to when you look at the perfection, when you look at the depiction in Revelation of the new heaven and the new earth and what things are like there compared to now. Paul's reference to, you know, now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, then we shall know even as we are known. You know, these are clearly ideas that are in Tolkien's head here. And I think if you want to see him talking about these ideas, that is especially this relation between creation and subcreation, more fully, you can see it in his poem Mythopoeia, and his sort of glimpsing towards this, that there will come a day when the subcreative art of limited, flawed human beings will be perfected. When we are perfected and joined unto God, then our own art will be part of his art. We will fully comprehend. We will know even as we are known, and you know, and then they shall be given being in the moment of their utterance, and he shall give to their thought the secret fire. It's pretty cool stuff. But I think that that's – so that's a long and sort of indirect answer to a much simpler question, but a very important one, I think, about the imperishable flame. It is certainly Chris, you've commented that you view it as, you know, the force of primary creation. I totally agree that creation, existence, might be an even better way to talk about it than life, because it's not just life, like living things as opposed to dead things. Really, when you're talking about the secret fire and the imperishable flame, you're talking about stuff that exists compared to stuff that doesn't have existence of itself, like the difference between the primary world and the secondary, and a secondary world, to use Tolkien's sort of creative language about that. That's very much how I conceive of the imperishable flame and sort of how it works. Let's see, Jordan?
Yeah, so there was a couple things, two things, where that I feel like Iluvatar is wrong, and it's kind of disturbing to me.
Okay.
First, he tells the group that Melkor, that anything he does in attempting to change the music will actually become more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined. And I would think that, although I'm skipping ahead, Húrin and Túrin Túrinbar would probably pretty strongly disagree that anything that Melkor can do is in fact going to turn out better for everyone involved. And then just two paragraphs later, he says that Melkor will discover all the secret thoughts of thy mind and will perceive that they are but a part of the whole and tributary to its glory. And again, at least by the end of our story, Melkor hasn't perceived any sort of tributary to its glory, and he doesn't seem to ever grasp the concept and So I don't know. It feels like Iluvatar is, in fact, wrong, and I don't understand how that could even be a possibility.
Right. That's a great question. Let me try to take those things separately. The first question, that is, I mean, and I love your point about, you know, Iluvatar's line about things turning out to be far more glorious, and your response, you know, let's ask the Hurin family and see what they have to say about that. Here, again, I would go back to the language that that Tolkien used originally in his first draft, the part that I read before from the Music of the Ainur in the Book of Lost Tales. And he's much more explicit and he's much more full in describing that. I think that it's clear that Tolkien would not think that Hurin and Turin were in any sense a contradiction of this principle. Because he says, let's see, and even shall those beings who must now dwell among his evil and endure through Melkor misery and sorrow, terror and wickedness. So even those people, just like the Hurin family, even those people who for whom things are worst during their lives, declare in the end that it redoundeth only to my great glory, and doth but make the theme more worth the hearing, life more worth the living, and the world so much the more wonderful and marvelous, that of all the deeds of Iluvatar it shall be called the mightiest and loveliest. Now, that's kind of easy to say, and you can say, well, yeah, I don't see that happening. Like, does that happen, like, before or after Turin kills himself? Like, yeah, I agree. But here, I think, it's sort of the big picture, right? Iluvatar is speaking in very big picture terms here. And when he says to Melkor, and thou, Melkor, shalt see, he's speaking in the future tense here, you know, you shall see. That no theme may be played that hath not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. And, you know, and that you will see that it's but part of the whole and tributary to its glory. Yeah, but what happens to them, what happens to the Valar, including Melkor, in one sense, most including Melkor, is that he enters into time. And that, a big deal is made of that when that happens. They descend into the world and they become, in a sense, limited by time because they operate within time exactly in the way that, according to Boethius, God does not. Okay? So their perspective on things becomes limited by the limitation of time. Hurin, of course, and Turin, all mortals, and, you know, the sort of the elves and men, all of the children of Iluvatar, are all of them restricted by time. And live very much within that. Live very much within that during their lifetimes, yes. Does this mean that after death, you know, humans who suffer will look back and say, okay, now I see, now I understand, maybe? Is he referring to in that moment after the end of time when all of the choir of the Ainur and the children come together and sort of collectively see it, possibly? I mean, he points to this moment, and again, this is where I just come back to that really beautiful language about, you know, the full comprehension and the sort of this final, full, and intimate connection between Iluvatar and his creatures, which he prophesies, you know, which we get that prophecy is going to come after the end of time. Not at the end of time, after the end of time. When this whole uncomfortable, limiting time thing is put aside entirely, then at that moment they will see. And it's, you know, I also kind of want to come back to Iluvatar's smile here. You know, it's making me also want to irreverently quote the Princess Bride. You know, why are you smiling? Because I know something you do not know, right? And that's Iluvatar's response. I know something that you do not know. Yet. They don't know it yet. Melkor doesn't know it yet. Certainly human beings don't know it yet, but there will come a time when everyone will know. And that time will be one, presumably for Melkor, one of wailing and gnashing of teeth, when he's going to recognize, yes, that all of my most triumphant notes, dang it, they actually were incorporated into Iluvatar's most beautiful music. And all of the, you know, the moments when I thought I was being most successful in setting up my own shop and rebelling against him, you know, actually, darn if I wasn't just like being tributary to his glory there. And by contrast, those, the, the good who have suffered, the good who have suffered evil, rather than the wicked who have perpetrated evil through their choice. The good who have suffered evil will see the whole picture, and will, Iluvatar tells us, smile along with him. But I know that in some ways that kind of seems unsatisfying. And this, I would say, all I could say about the way in which it seems like it seems like kind of a cop out. Like, okay, yeah, well, things are miserable now, but trust me, don't worry about it. Like later on, we're all gonna look back and laugh at this at some point. You know, like it'll all be fine. Like I know that doesn't sound really satisfying, but the one thing that I would say to try to moderate the unsatisfactory nature of that statement is the fact that Tolkien doesn't just shortchange it. It's really unsatisfactory to say, hey, evil, suffering, whatever, you know, it's not really a big deal. Don't worry about it. You know, just try to ignore the suffering and keep in mind that, you know, big picture, everything's cool. If that's all that somebody says, then it's nauseating, and it seems really unsatisfying because it's totally out of touch with how the world really is. Nobody can say that the Silmarillion is out of touch with suffering and doesn't take suffering seriously. The pathos of this book matches the pathos of any book that I know. I don't know of any work of literature which is more agonizing to read than the Silmarillion. You get pain and suffering and pain and suffering treated with dignity and seriousness and compassion. Tolkien is going to spend a lot of time showing what things are like now and taking seriously what things are like now. But we start off, very importantly, start off with this glimpse, with this promise, Iluvatar's prediction. You know what? Trust me, this is all going to make sense. You will see. You probably don't see it now. You probably can't see it now. Because A, you're in the middle of time, and B, you're human anyway. And so, therefore, you don't have an infinite brain. But there will come a time when you will see. And I think it's tricky. It's tricky. But I think that's kind of where it comes down. So for those reasons, I don't think that in either one of those things, Iluvatar is being inaccurate. He's just speaking to the much bigger picture and looking kind of further down the road. Though again, you notice even there, when I say he's looking further down the road, that time language has crept in there, right? I've talked about him like he's operating within time and seeing into the far distant future. It's one of the interesting things. Even when you're trying to resist that, it's really hard to resist that kind of vocabulary. That is time-related vocabulary. Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm interested in possible inspirations outside of Christianity. We know that Tolkien was a very devout Catholic, and you can definitely see parallels with the Bible and this book, especially with the fall of Melkor, fall of Lucifer. But I also see some other parallels with other religions and other mythologies. Maybe it's just the universals between various religions, but for instance, with Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering which is caused by the illusion of separateness. Melkor introduces suffering through discord, which is rooted in his illusion of separateness. He wants to be separate. He wants to be independent. He wants to create and have dominion and control over that creation, and sort of elevate himself over the rest and play the role of Iluvatar, which leads to his fall. I don't know. I haven't read all the letters of Tolkien. I haven't. There's so much material. But have you read, or do you think that there's other inspirations? Obviously, he was well-read. He probably read outside of Catholicism. But that's just a question of curiosity.
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to figure out how to respond to this in an orderly way. On the one hand, yes, certainly. You know, are there other worldviews other than the Catholic worldview which impacted him? Yeah, I mean, I would say number one among those is the Norse worldview. You know, he knew and loved the writings of many non-Christian traditions, and saw the significance of those. I mean, if you think this would be a big digression if I were to really try to do it justice. So I won't try to do it justice, but it's his thinking about myth in general, and you know, the sort of the conversations that he and C.S. Lewis and the other Inklings had about myth. You know, they believed in myth and the significance of myth because they see stories in many different traditions, which are myth, which get at truth, and you can see truth being expressed and echoed in lots of different places. So certainly, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, both C.S. Lewis, of course, as is usual, speaks about this much more directly in some of his Christian writings. That is his nonfiction stuff. You know, C.S. Lewis argues, you know, says that one thing that being a Christian does not mean that you have to believe that all other religions are wrong all the way through, but rather all of them have some glimpse of truth, some more, some less, says Lewis. Now, of course, one always has to resist the temptation to take things from C.S. Lewis's books and say he and Tolkien were friends, and so therefore Tolkien thinks this too. He and Lewis disagreed about many things, but I don't think they disagreed about this one. That is about myth and the nature of myth. So in general, are there other traditions that impact it? Yeah, absolutely. But not, I think, perhaps in a way that we might think about, or in terms that we might frequently think about it. That is, it's not just about like creating a sort of a syncretistic myth out of several different traditions. I don't think Tolkien would have been thinking that way, just kind of bringing them together. He, you know, does speak in his letters about sort of when it comes to the theology, the fundamental theology of his mythology, that, you know, he does say, you know, there's nothing in his theology which is not fundamentally consistent, you know, with the belief in the Trinity, you know, as it's described in the Bible. So, I mean, he definitely sees it in that sense. But at the same time, it's not just what he's doing. Here's another way possibly to approach it, this question. It's not... Sometimes when people want to talk about sort of how Christian or how Catholic is Tolkien's world, is Tolkien's mythology, sometimes I think what people are thinking about or saying there is what Tolkien is doing sort of self-conscious Christian apologetics? You know, is he setting out to say, I'm going to depict Christian theology? You know, I'm gonna try to describe Christian theology in a way that sort of makes it more accessible. C.S. Lewis does this, you know, but and I think, I mean, the Chronicles of Narnia are a really prime example. One of the things that C.S. Lewis is wanting to do in the Chronicles of Narnia, he is using he is telling stories, but he is also using the stories as a vehicle. He is you know, using them as a way to sort of get at ideas imaginatively that are really hard to explain. Just to use one simple example, the repeated doctrinal concept in the Chronicles of Narnia about Aslan not being a tame lion, right? All of the discussion, and you see this, I've just been reading the Chronicles of Narnia with my son, Nicholas, who's 7. And so I've been really noticing this. Whenever Aslan comes in and you look at the way that the characters respond to Aslan, Lewis is very self-conscious. You know, he is very self-consciously working out his ideas about the nature of God and the relationship between humans and God, and what that's like through the character of Aslan. Tolkien, like, is Tolkien doing something like that? In some sense, yes. In some sense, no. In some sense, yes, in that, like, you know, I mean, there's Ilúvatar. Is Ilúvatar God? Well, yes, yes, he is, in one sense. This is certainly, the Ainul Indale does work out, you know, many aspects of Christian theology in some really clear ways. But is he setting out to do it in the way that Lewis was? No, he wasn't. Tolkien was not an apologist. And in fact, it's one of the things that was a real source of tension between Lewis and Tolkien. Tolkien was not comfortable with what Lewis did. He didn't think it was Lewis's place. Lewis wasn't a priest. And he did not think it was Lewis's place as a layman to step forward and be like trying to explain theology to everybody. And he had no interest in that himself. So I don't think he's being self-conscious about it in that way. It's not like he is trying to convey to his readers these theological concepts, but nevertheless, those things are definitely there. So yeah, I think that's something that's important to remember. Because again, I think that sometimes people oversimplify the situation when they want to say, like, is this, you know, is Tolkien's mythology a Christian mythology, or is it, you know, also other, from other belief systems as well. He was subcreating. He was making a mythology. He was doing, to use the word that he coined, he was doing mythopoeia. He was wanting to write myth. Does that mean he is telling a Christian story? No, not in the sense of apologetics, not in the sense of, like, I am going to try to explain Christianity. But were the ideas that he was pointing to Christian ideas? Well, yes, because he was still, what writing myth meant was pointing to truth, the truth which Tolkien believed Catholicism pointed to. And so in that sense, yes, of course, they're Christian, they're Catholic, they're deeply Christian and Catholic. So anyway, that's sort of a long answer to that. We should probably wrap up soon, but Mike, go ahead.
Hi. I had a question about the passage that begins, "And this habitation might seem a little thing to those who consider only the majesty of the Ainur." It refers to the pillar, the bitter than a needle, the summit, the cone. I read through that a couple of times, and I just could not make sense of that. What's going on in that passage?
Yeah, that's a good question. That passage is a little bit confusing. Let's see. What page are we on?
I'm on page 7, but I'm not in the edition you're on.
Oh, yeah, you're in a different edition.
It's the paragraph that begins, "Now the children of Ilúvatar are elves and men, the firstborn and the followers."
Right. Okay, great. Got it. Thanks. So let me just back up a little bit here. "And amid all the splendors of the world, its vast halls and spaces, and its wheeling fires, Ilúvatar chose a place for their habitation in the deeps of time and in the midst of the innumerable stars. And this habitation might seem a little thing to those who consider only the majesty of the Ainur and not their terrible sharpness." Now, just stopping there, what he's saying is the initial premise is this little planet. Okay. One thing to keep in mind, and this you can see, although Tolkien is not doing apologetics like C.S. Lewis was, he still is existing in the same place that Lewis was, and part of the same culture, and reading many of the same books and magazines, and taking part in many of the same debates kind of privately. If you read a lot of C.S. Lewis, one of the things that as an apologist, one of the ideas that Lewis responds to a lot is the objection against Christianity, which was really popular in the first half of the 20th century, which was, since now we know that we are all, that, you know, Earth is just this one tiny little insignificant planet circling around this one insignificant star in the middle of a vast cosmos, you know, how can we think that, like, there is transcendent significance to anything that happens on this one little speck of dirt? That was a very popular objection to Christianity, as I say, and Lewis responds to this objection many, many, many times in his writings. And I think you can see the same kind of thought in Tolkien here. He's saying, amid all the splendors of the world, and when he says the world here, capital W, I don't think he means the planet here. He means the universe. When what is Ea? Ea is not just a planet. Ea is the physical universe, right? I mean, the whole thing that all that is Ea, has been brought to being. So the vision and everything, this is for all of the cosmos, really. So amid all the splendors of the world, the whole cosmos, it's cosmos means world, it's vast halls and spaces, it's wheeling fires. So here we're looking at in all of the galaxies and all of the known universe, Iluvatar chose a place for their habitation in the deeps of time and in the midst of the innumerable stars. Now we're talking about the planet. Okay. This habitation, the planet, might seem a little thing to those who consider only the majesty of the Ainur and not their terrible sharpness. Right? So he's saying it might seem weird, right, that given A, that we have these vast beings, and we get this sort of glimpse here, this sort of reminder, this brief from the children of Iluvatar's perspective on the whole creation process, because with the story focusing on Iluvatar and the Ainur, it can sound like, you know, a sort of a private party, and like everybody's sort of operating on a similar level and sort of on our level, thinking back again to the point that Jack made way earlier about the metaphors and the ways in which this story is being accommodated to the comprehension of and the experience of mortal beings. You know, it's being told in their terms, but we get this reminder here. By the way, yeah, the Ainur, these are like phenomenal cosmic powers, right? These beings are so spiritually massive. You know, they have such enormous stature that it seems hard even to imagine a whole bunch of them coming and living on this tiny little planet, when this planet is only one speck out of this whole huge creation, which is itself an embodiment of their song, right? They conceive the whole thing. So he's addressing in this passage. Okay, so it might seem odd, it might seem strange, it might seem incomprehensible that all of these great cosmic powers like the Valar would descend onto this little speck of dirt. But, he says, so this habitation might seem a little thing to those who consider only the majesty of the Ainur and not their terrible sharpness. How sharp are they, right? As who should take the whole field of Arda for the foundation of a pillar, and so raise it until the cone of its summit were more bitter than a needle. So he's sort of comparing it. What are the Valar like? Well, the Valar they're like a mountain, okay? A mountain whose base, or a pillar, he says, but I mean, it's like a mountain because they're a cone, whose base is as wide as the whole planet, but then it soars up and it tapers, but it doesn't just, it's not just massive. It also gets down until its point is as bitter, is as sharp as a needle. They're very small as well as very big. They come down to a fine point. And so if you consider that sort of visual metaphor of the huge, broad planetary base of the pillar and the needle-sharp point of the top of the pillar, and he's saying both of those things are the Valar. The Valar are both of those things. They are as broad and strong and huge and powerful as the planetary base of that imaginary pillar, and they are also as fine, sharp, detailed, and precise as the needle tip of that same pillar. And then he continues on, or who consider only the immeasurable vastness of the world, which still the Ainur are shaping, and not the minute precision to which they shape all things therein. That is, when you think of the Valar, he says, think not only of galactic structure and huge astronomical distances, think also of the structure of cells. You know, think also of subatomic particles. All of those things are the thought of the Ainur. They are involved not only in the greatness of the big picture that shows how big and huge they are, but also in the meticulous detail of the tiniest microscopic and subatomic things. So he says, if you think about the Valar's being in that way, they're not just huge things which would overlook the Earth entirely. They don't overlook anything. They are also involved in the finest fine-tuning of every speck of everything. So, again, all of this is in the context of, so why would it make sense for them to come and live on a planet? Well, this is why it makes sense for them to live on a planet, because it is not absurd when compared to their overall being. Yeah. Yes, and Justin, you are right. Yes, I did make both an Aladdin reference and a Princess Bride reference. So I think I'm done now. I should end on that triumphant note. Not exactly higher than the firmament and deeper than the abyss, but you know. But there it is. All right. Well, it's 11:15, and I still have to grade some exams, so we should probably go. But thanks very much, everybody, for participating. This has been a lot of fun. I look forward to the Valaquenta next week. So the Valaquenta, of course, is pretty short, but we'll do a lot of names and really be there looking at the nature of the Valar and how everything's go together. So make sure – come prepared with questions if there's stuff that you definitely want to talk about, especially – our opening stuff, simple questions, clarifications, names, pronunciations, lots more pronunciations to happen, I think, in the Valaquenta. So thanks, everybody, and we'll sign off now. Good night, everyone. Okay, special thanks to David Kale for undertaking the long and thankless task of editing these sessions for the podcast. The next session of the seminar was scheduled for a week later, but I should be able to post the audio recording of it in less than a week, hopefully by New Year's. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.